You cannot talk about cannabis without bringing in the political. Colorado is a state that has decriminalized both recreational and medicinal cannabis, as have other states. However, federally, it is still prohibited. And that has really cast a pall, and that has really impacted the ability of states like Colorado, but also researchers and doctors and clinicians to fully get to grips with the potential of this. The last time we spoke, Professor Sievers, was May 2016, and it was a very different political environment, even though it was only about 18 months ago. And it seems politically we have not moved towards any type of lifting of the federal prohibition of cannabis. In fact, we've moved towards even further criminalization of it, and threats being made against states that have actually lifted prohibition. How does the political reality and the political attitudes towards cannabis impact folks like yourselves, who are researchers, who are clinicians, who are chemists?
Well, I think the the federal government has been out of step with even the federal electorate. Everyone except a couple I can think of. Arizona didn't in the last election approve the legalization, but now at least 33 states have passed legislation, and these are some of our most populous states that have legalized either industrial hemp, which is a special form of cannabis that we'll get to in a moment, and a lot of states, even in the Deep South, where there's been some pushback, have nonetheless passed state laws that allow you to do research with cannabidiol, a non-psychoactive, a non-addictive constituent, the second most abundant in most cannabis preparations, a cannabinoid. And so CBD is worlds different from THC, and that's one of the messages that I hope to convey to the audience, and I'll have lots of help from some very distinguished other speakers that I'll get to in a minute.
And just to clarify then for our general listening audience right now, CBD has the potential for the healing and the various different, I suppose, biotechnical impacts, but it does not have that psychotropic or that psychoactive component that THC has.
That's very true. And it's widely recognized among users as well as among people being treated that to have these in the same basket with heroin is ridiculous. They have cannabidiol has nowhere near the impact on world health or U.S. Health that things in so-called Schedule One, which are intended for the most addictive or the most dangerous or the most problematic of all of our drugs. And there it sits, even though there have been numerous attempts to change the federal law. Also, banking laws have made it very dicey to work in this field. It becomes unsafe. It becomes a hazard. It costs money to lose your standing in a bank in your state, and you have to find another bank that will then do your banking for you. So there are all kinds of impediments that have been put in the way, and especially in the United States, not in the rest of the world, and the rest of the world is racing on ahead, and in countries like Israel and like Australia and like in various countries in Europe, the United Kingdom, I could name Spain and Italy and Germany and the Netherlands and the Scandinavian countries, where they have been going ahead with research and they've recognized these differences that we've been slow to recognize, and I hold the fact that there continues to be a conflict between our state laws and our federal laws as one of the biggest and saddest failures on the part of the federal government to get consistent with what most of the people have wanted and voted for. So it's not a question of the people being against it. It's been a question of the ineptitude and the dysfunction of the federal government, in my opinion.
Getting back to the federal classification of cannabis, right now it's in the same classification, Schedule A, as heroin. At the same time, we're seeing this massive opioid addiction crisis here in the US of prescription drugs, of drugs that doctors have written prescriptions for. Not everyone who is addicted to opioids have had a prescription written, however, many have. And people are really examining what has happened here, where you have major pharmaceutical companies that have reaped huge profits from this. Now, at the same time, more research is being done or trying to be done into the role that cannabis could play, either as a replacement in terms of opioid for pain management, but also helping with the actual addiction crisis right now. Tell us a little bit about the connection between the two.
Well, absolutely. First, let me make sure that people understand the difference between the different terms we've been using. Cannabis is used as sort of a general term that includes about 100 different cannabinoids and a lot of other compounds that are inactive. Things even that we smell when we think we're smelling marijuana are called terpenoids, and these are the same compounds that are in our pine trees, and when we go for a walk in the forest, we're exposing ourselves to that. But to come back to what the legal definition of cannabis, of marijuana is, as contrasted with industrial hemp, the law says that if you have less than 0.3%, that's less than 1%, of THC in the cannabis plant, that is not marijuana. It is hemp, and hemp is not dangerous in terms of the same way that marijuana is potentially addictive, only because of the THC, the tetrahydrocannabinol, that is present in strains of cannabis that are bred specifically to have a high or to make you giggle or give you a buzz or whatever it is for recreational purposes. We're focusing now on what the medical aspects are, and that is where the low THC but high CBD or cannabidiol, which is a medically active and yet non-addictive form of cannabis is. And so there's a very interesting study coming out of Mount Sinai Hospital, and it's on YouTube, and I urge that people search it out. It's by Yasmin, Yasmin, Hurd, H-U-R-D, at Mount Sinai Hospital. And in that, she is showing that in rodents, rats, who have been self-administering heroin, that if you give the rats CBD, it either blocks the urging or the craving of the animal for more of the addictive stuff that they've been punching the button to deliver to themselves. And so that's a really a breakthrough in terms of understanding that here we have something that it's hard to pick a term that is describes it adequately, that you could call it an antidote, maybe you could call it a prophylactic, but something that keeps you from getting addicted or allows you to get off of an opiate if you have become addicted. So that's a major breakthrough, and we've got to sit up and take notice and stop beating people down and taking the cheap way out and saying, well, we'll warehouse these people in the empty hospital beds that are set aside now for all the addicts that we have. And that's the wrong approach, in my opinion.
Or put them in prison.
Exactly. Or one of the great tragedies has been to imprison people who have sadly become addicted. That's one of the great mistakes we've made along the way. The drug war has been a failure in part because people didn't understand that, or they had misgivings about it, or whatever, but now we simply have to look this squirrel in the face, and we have to take steps, because we're losing out in every dimension. We're losing our next generation of young people.
There has also been some research done into the potential for cannabidiol CBD to also help with pain relief, in
exactly.
which case opioids would not need to be prescribed in the first place. So it could actually stop that cycle of addiction by eliminating the need for opioids in the first place.
Exactly. And if you listen to the president's speech the other day, one of the most important thing that the reporters seem to have missed or not jotted down on their notebooks, but what he said was, we need effective, non-addictive pain medicines. And the cannabinoids are sitting there looking at us, and cannabidiol in particular is known to be an alternative pain medication. And yet there has not been the flexibility, there's not been the willingness of people in both political parties to work together to bring a bipartisan bill to the Congress and get it passed. And that's astounding to me.
What is it like for you as a researcher? You spent your life in research, in chemistry, biochemistry, environmental studies, to have these barriers. I mean, what is the reality? If you're at a publicly funded university, CU Boulder,
correct?
There are other publicly funded universities. I use that term lightly, given how much public funds actually go into the university versus how much private funding goes into. But we'll, use that commonly used term. But for publicly funded research institutions, universities, for a researcher who wants to research some of these issues,
yes.
what hoops must they jump through? What steps must
yes.
they go through to do this?
Well, there are some internal and there are some that are external. And the internal ones are manageable. Those are the ones we've dealt with all along. If you want to do experiments using animals, you have to go to the Animal Care Review Committee within your university, within your hospital, and make sure that they understand the protocol you're going to use, no undue or unavoidable pain, treat the animals right, all the things you'd expect to do. That's understandable, and that we can handle. The second thing is we have internal review boards, ethics committees, if you will, which say, all right, you want to do experiments now with people. So first, in traditional pharmacology, we do experiments with animals, and then only then we decide whether the risks are manageable enough and low enough that we'll have more benefit than likely harm in going ahead and administering test pharmaceuticals, beneficial drugs, not drugs of abuse, to people, first in adults and then in children. And so those are the steps we have to go through. But now on top of that, and here's where the real rub comes, the National Institute of Drug Abuse and the Drug Enforcement Administration, an element of the Department of Justice, control where you can get materials, and some of those are insufficiently pure and suitable for research. They control whether you can even have them in your lab, where you keep them locked up. They have insisted on guard towers at places like the University of Mississippi, which has been sort of the nation's default supplier of substances like THC and CBD and the cannabis plant itself. So those are the impediments, and sometimes you have to wait for years. I've been waiting for 3 years now. I've filed all the paperwork with the Drug Enforcement Administration. I told them what I wanted to do, try to study post-traumatic stress syndrome and pain relief and those sorts of things, and ways of making more pure substances and reducing the risk that there will be formulations that aren't stable or other hazards to people. Those are the things I want to do. I've said all that over and over again. And yet for 3 years, and in the case of Sue Sisley, who is a much more famous example, it was 7 years that they drug out her application before they finally provided her sample. And now she has analyzed that and has started trying to work with it. and it turns out that the sample is unsuitable for as a research material, in her opinion, and that's a serious setback for all the veterans coming back. The number of veterans that take their own lives is tragic, and many of those are involved with deep psychological problems that need our help, and the Veterans Administration has been blocked even from giving advice about whether cannabinoids would be useful for people coming back in severe stress modes. So all those things make serious researchers at universities and medical schools around the world very sad, but we have extra burdens that could easily be changed, could easily be removed, would easily make progress faster, would reduce the number of people that die from things like the opiate crisis or diseases that can be helped, like serious forms of epilepsy, like certain forms of cancer, like certain forms of diseases that result from the body rebelling against or attacking itself. And those are all the things that our distinguished panel are going to be talking about on November the 11th down at Anschutz in Education Building 2.
Given that there are years now in terms of the barriers and the delays, essentially, yes, for American researchers, what research is being done in universities and institutions around the world, whether it's Europe or Israel, those different countries that you mentioned?
Well, let's take Israel first, and it's a really a broad spectrum of things that they've been able to do. Clearly, one of the things that has been done both in the United States with great problems to get going on it, but it finally has happened, has been the work on epilepsy and the serious forms of epilepsy that result in multiple seizures every day. And so there's been success there both around the world in different labs and universities. A fascinating thing to me is some work that's being done on faster bone healing. So in animals, they've been able to show in Israel that test animals who have broken bones and things like that heal much faster if a little bit of cannabidiol is given to them during their healing stage. If you go on and on, certainly pain reduction is important, stress reduction is important, Parkinson's disease. We could go through the list of major things that are facing us. Arthritis pain, fibromyalgia, one of the things that is going to be talked about by a panel in Anschutz is understanding better whether cannabinoids women who are breastfeeding take actually show up in the milk that the child then gets. And that's obviously undesirable. This is one of the things that is going to be talked about. Another issue is the question of how does it affect driving to have someone that has had some of the psychoactive material, THC, and then gets in their car and is a real hazard on the road. So we're talking about a field that is manageable and where people can make constructive contributions if only the government gets out of our way and reduces regulation, which our president says he wants to do.
Is there a concern that people will self-medicate, and they will self-medicate with plants that we don't know the potency of, that they'll self-medicate in states where they can't access legal medical marijuana, something from the black market? And in which case, you know, has this ever happened before where a drug that you have a certain set of researchers doing research into, but it's not available yet, people are just taking it anyway? Is that of concern to researchers, that we have essentially people not so much experimenting on themselves, but self-medicating, and we don't know, you know, the correct dosages, we don't know any of these things?
Well, absolutely. And over history, cannabis has been used for more than 2,000 years, and so there's been a lot of self-medicating along the way, but the notion that we are running a big experiment on ourselves rather than doing it in the traditional way, which is test it in animals first and then test it very carefully and very systematically and in a very controlled way by clinical trials. So yes, it worries us, and no, it's not a good idea. But people are desperate. People are seeing their friends die, and they're seeing people in pain, and they're seeing people, and so they're willing to do things that they wouldn't normally do if we weren't in these troubled and turbulent times. When you don't know what to believe because of the political situation and the habits we've gotten into there.
Now, you're a former CU regent, so you know the reality of politics as it, you know, pertains to academia.
Mm-hmm.
Has there ever been an example of a research area that has been blocked so much by a political reality as we're seeing right now?
I'm trying to think. This has been, I think, the worst in my lifetime. And this has been a time when other people are willing to interfere with what we call academic freedom in a way that is really strange and, in my mind, unacceptable. As a regent, I fought for academic freedom in every form. I tried to insist on respect for other people's ideas, and I didn't think there ought to be anything that was off the table as long as everything had been considered as far as the consideration of risk versus benefit. No, in my mind, I can't think of any time that academic freedom has been under attack. I mean, when you have people who object to climate change research, object to immigration, object to people being here that they don't think should be sharing our soil. This is the worst time I can remember in my 80-some years.
What would you like to see happen? What changes, real tangible things, could actually improve the current situation regarding research and the potential development of CBD for medicinal purposes?
Well, first of all, we've got to make sure that the pushback is done for the right reasons if there is pushback. And by pushback, I mean throwing up barriers in the way of legitimate scientific research and the funding of this and the publication of this and the allowance of this. So there are several bills pending in Congress which would legalize CBD or would make it easier for researchers to obtain samples for research and to do certain kinds of experiments that are peer-reviewed and that are not subject to extremists on either side of the political spectrum trying to tell you what you can and cannot do. Academic freedom is one of the greatest freedoms we have, and we have to guard it because it goes away, as we saw in the 1930s, if you aren't careful. It goes away if you don't have the courage to stand up and if you don't vote when you have a chance to vote. How many of us stayed home instead of voting because we thought the election was a foregone conclusion? I think those are the principal things I would mention.
And then in terms of society's attitudes, I mean, given that there are so many states now that have passed by voter approval some type of cannabis legislation, whether it's medicinal or recreational, do you think that, you know, society's perception has changed, that it's no longer as taboo, that it's the federal government that needs to catch up, or are there still inroads to be made at a societal level in terms of our attitudes?
Well, there probably are, and we all have our biases, and and we have to look at them carefully and say, well, are those biases well-founded, or is it because somebody has told me I should vote that way, or have I thought this through? I think that right now we could hope that there would be bilateral consideration in both parties of, and there are plenty of Republicans that are now supporting some form of relaxation of these restrictive drug laws that have been in place. And so it's not a Democrat versus Republican issue as much as it may have been at one time.